This is the history of America in poems, and we're talking about children's poetry now, and we're going to launch into the modernists next, an era from 1913 to the 1950s, and we're starting the second half of this class on children's poetry, and it's running long, you might have noticed. I think this is because we're not chunking by time. We're not doing the periodization thing. We're doing all the children's poems together. So hang in there. This is probably going to be twice as long as the other pod classes. And but it's probably going to be the most fun, too, because it's children's poetry. And also, before we continue, I want to say that if I sometimes forget to note the date of each poem, which I notice I am doing, that don't worry, I'm listing them on the class page. So as you go to click on the links to find and read the poems, you're going to see the date of each poem's publication. So apologies for that, but sometimes I get chatty and I forget to talk about the date. Anyway, let's get into these modernist children's poems. I also like to think of this section as schoolhouse poetry too, because a lot of people my age and a little bit older were taught these poems in school. And a lot of these poems ended up in English literature classes all the way from grade school into college. So I think just like the fireside poets, these poets are also schoolroom poets. The first example being the example most people my parents' age or maybe a little younger talk about as being the poem they had to memorize in school when they were kids, the tree poem. I think I shall never see a poem as lovely as a tree. They can all trot out that first line as evidence that they indeed did have to memorize it in school. And it was probably the most popular poem for rote memorization when they were kids. And just to describe what rote memorization means, because I looked it up today, because I was like, how is that different than regular old-fashioned memorization? And what rote memorization means is that it's just memorizing words and, you know, in a certain order. It's all about sound and order. There's no underlying discussion of what the facts mean or what the words mean. It's just the act of simple memorization, which was a popular teaching technique for a time. And then now it's not. When I was growing up, it was not. We didn't do much memorization at all, which is good because I can't do it very well. And now it's much more contextual learning, so which I loved. I liked that. I wanted to know why and what it all meant. So we're going to start with the most famous modernist poet. Well, I mean, he's really tangentially modernist, Robert Frost. He was included in the group of modernists. He was respected by the modernists, but he was much more formalist and less experimental than, well, on the, you know, ostensibly less experimental. He was actually experimental, but not in the ways that the other modernists like T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound were. So, but they did respect him, and they kind of included him as a tangential modernist. And so he's definitely usually taught as part of modernism. But Angela Sorby, in her essay on children's poetry up to 1920, said that Robert Frost had a secret early career as a children's poet. But then most people don't know this because most of his biographies ignore this whole phase of his career, and they don't take it seriously. But he, in fact, did have his most early poems published in The Youth's Companion, and his early publications were considered children's poems. But also, I want to say that his adult poems are probably the most taught poems of modernists to children. So, and I think Angela Sorby would agree, because The Road Not Taken and Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening are always in anthologies. In fact, she says that, Sorby says that Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening is probably the most commonly taught poem. So we'll look at it in a second. But the first poem I want to look at is called Reluctance from 1913. And it is sort of a metaphor of travel as life. And so it's kind of speaks ahead to the Dr. Seuss poem we're going to be looking at the very end of this. Oh, the places we will go, as life, travel is life, life is travel. So I will read a little bit of it. The heart is still aching to seek. Was it ever less than a treason to go with the drift of things, to yield with a grace to reason, and bow and accept the end of a love or a season? So this end is definitely the theme of innocence to experience, and it's also a travel poem. So that's Reluctance. The next poem we're going to look at is The Road Not Taken, which I would have thought would be the most commonly taught poem, because it was the most commonly taught poem to me. I came across this poem in grade school all the way up through college, and definitely the poem I saw the most in school. And it is too a travel poem, and I think all three of these poems that we're going to look at from Robert Frost are travel poems. But the interesting thing about this poem is that readers and critics are starting to change their mind about what it might mean, this poem. Because for about 100 years, we were teaching this poem as meaning that choices are meaningful, that which makes all the difference. Your choice makes all the difference. But in the, you know, recently, maybe in the last 10 or 20 years, I don't know how long, critics, I mean, I'm seeing this in essays about the poem now, that it could actually mean, Robert Frost could actually mean, that our choices are actually meaningless, or maybe meaningless. And it all hinges on the sentence in the last stanza. Well, first, the sentence in the second stanza that says, the choices are just as fair. You know, in looking at both choices, there really is no difference. He's admitting that in stanza two. But then when you get down to the last stanza, the sentence, the crucial sentence that, you know, new readers are picking up on is, I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. So I shall be telling this. This is actually, I looked up the tense, it's future continuous, meaning the outcome has not happened yet. You know, he has not been saying this yet, because he hasn't told his story yet. And so it's going to be performative. It's going to be predetermined spin that which made all the difference. You can't tell now if it's really true, which is great. I love this new interpretation of the poem, because it's less about, it's more about life being sort of foggy and inconclusive, and less about this dichotomy of two choices when you hit a fork in the road and it being so simple. Because I don't think that's a true reflection of life, and I don't really think Robert Frost thought that either. So, and in this new interpretation also, it's now about the myth-making of the self, which is a great new way to look at this poem. So read it again and see if you can see both interpretations in it. The poem's also about protecting the past, projecting the future, if we read it with this new lens. So it's a travel poem also. It falls into those categories of American themes. The next poem, The Road Not Taken, was from 1915.
And the next poem, Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening, is from 1922. It's also a travel poem about innocence and experience, and the darkness of the woods has returned. But it's really a metaphor for the darkness of the self. So it's a travel poem. It's an innocence to experience poem. And that's all we're going to read from Robert Frost. We're going to move on to The Woodpecker from 1922 by Elizabeth Maddox Roberts. And this is about the woodpecker as being practical and using his ingenuity, which is part of American identity making. So that's why I included this poem. And I included a cute poem of hers called Mumps, also from 1922. And because it's about the experience of children having mumps and being stuck with each other so they could all get mumps together and then move on with their lives. And so parents, the early medicine of parents getting all the kids sick at the same time was interesting. And it reminded me of everybody I knew who had this experience of being stuck as a healthy kid with a sick sibling to try to catch what they had. This never happened to me because apparently in Albuquerque, my mother said my nickname was Typhoid Mary because I would get sick first and then all the kids in the neighborhood would get sick. So, yeah, I did it that way. We're going to move on to Swift Things Are Beautiful by Elizabeth Coatsworth. And I included this poem because of the last few lines of it that read, "And the ox that moves on in the quiet of power." And this seemed very American to me, especially for the time. I mean, right, like currently, I don't think our power is so quiet anymore. You know, maybe it's a little blowhardy, but this is back in the 1920s. And I think the ox moves on in the quiet of power is very American. And I think it's also site of conflict. Anytime you talk about power, that's going to be a site of conflict. So I just want to say that, you know, I'm calling these schoolhouse poems, but technically, the modernists were very critical of the schoolhouse poets, the earlier schoolhouse poets, the fireside poets, the poets of the turn of the century, the Gilded Age poets. And Angela Sorby says that the modernist poets, like T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound, that group of poets, they're the ones that banned adult books and children's books into separate areas. So that's an interesting idea. But around this time, children's poetry was seen as something that adults, that there was no value in reading it. I don't think they would ever. I think that's why Angela Sorby and our other essayist, I'm going to go back and look, Joseph T. Thomas Jr. had to write essays pulling forth the value of reading children's poetry. And I think that was a mistake. Well, I think modernists made a lot of mistakes. And they started excluding a lot of poets that we're now starting to rediscover, thankfully. And I don't think children's poetry really needed to be rediscovered because it's actually the most popular selling poetry out there. But as far as academic value or, you know, adult reading value, it's sort of being resurrected, at least in these essays it is. So this is a good segue into the poet Carl Sandburg, because he was also another target of the modernists because of his pro-labor and working class themes in his poetry, and also because, like all the other poets that were excluded, the women who wrote lyrics, the Harlem Renaissance poets to some degree, children's poetry, everything we've talked about, they weren't experimental enough for the modernists. That was another big reason they were excluded. And I think when we rediscover them now, we're starting to see some experimentation that's just in a different areas and on a different level than the modernists wanted the experiments to be. So that was the split. But this was the era of a magazine called The Masses, which published a lot of left-wing poetry, political poetry. And this was all going on during the Gilded Age, so it was not... understandable that there'd be a reaction to the wealth redistribution during the Gilded Age. And so there were left-wing magazines that existed back then to publish these political poems. And the most famous of these working class poets was Carl Sandburg from Chicago. And he, we're going to talk about him later because he has some great poems about Chicago. But he's also being resurrected again in modernist classes. So I've taken about 5 classes online in modernism. And some, like one class was just about classic modernists. One class was about modernists by location. And that included London, New York, and Chicago, so Carl Sandburg was included in that class. And then another class was just rescuing modernist era poets that had been excluded by the high modernists. So he was also included in that class. So he's an interesting character, I think. So I'm including a lot of his early short poems that were kind of skewed more toward children. And one of them is Early Moon from 1918. And it's about a mythical past. It's about retelling the past. And every time you retell the past, that's automatically a political site of conflict. So that falls in that bucket. Wind Song is a later poem from 1960, but it's about leisure, frugality. There's a political layer of it that where the wind stands in for the wealthy class. That's an interesting poem. Fog from 1916. It's interesting when you think about Chicago fog, if you've ever been in, which in the middle of winter, you could get stuck in Chicago fog off the lake. So that's an interesting poem about urban spaces. Fog is portrayed as an animal. Arithmetic is a poem from 1930, which is a humorous educational poem about teaching math. Buffalo Dusk from 1920 is again about protecting the past. How do we speak of the past? Who gets to speak of the past? So that's a site of conflict, again, right there. And the last poem from Sandburg is going to be Primer Lesson from 1922. Again, this is skewed as a children's poem, but it's kind of an adult poem about, it's definitely a self-help poem and about dealing with pride. So that's an interesting poem. We're going to leave Sandburg now and move on to E.E. Cummings. I've picked one children's poem called Injust. And I think it presents kind of a childhood American idol of innocence. But take a look, read it yourself. I mean, E.E. Cummings can withstand. There's room for other interpretations in E.E. Cummings poems. So that's just my take on that one. That's from 1920. And then we're going to move on to Langston Hughes, one of the Harlem Renaissance poets. And I've picked 3 poems here that deal with the American dream. And I don't think there's any other writer who writes more directly about the American dream than Langston Hughes. And so we have The Dream Keeper from 1925. We have Dreams from 1922. And we have Dream Variation from 1926. And this is all about, I mean, the American dream is always about reinvention and discovery. And it's always going to be a site of conflict, especially like who has access to this American dream. So those are 3 great poems. And then we move on to one poem by William Carlos Williams, another high modernist. And this poem is called The Turtle. And it is from 1956. And it's a poem that William Carlos Williams wrote for his grandson. But it has themes of power and imperialism, which is, again, right into the site of conflict bucket. The poem talks about murderous motives. He will stride about the world. This is the turtle. He will stride about the world, destroying all. There was a great tortoise who supported the world. Upon him, all ultimately rests. Without him, nothing will stand. So this is a very interesting poem, especially when you know we're going to talk about Dr. Seuss's Yertle the Turtle in a few sessions. So I don't know if this poem was an influence in Yertle the Turtle, but maybe it was. It's definitely an interesting foreshadowing of that. And then William Carlos Williams' poem, The Red Wheelbarrow, which another poem I would have thought would be the most taught poem, most commonly taught poem, because it kept coming up everywhere, almost in every class. And it's pretty easy to memorize, pretty short poem, so I can see why it's popular to teach. Also because it's a good example of what the modernists called imagism, but we'll get to that. It's more of an adult idea. I think it's a great poem from a child's point of view, just about place, just about the American farm, the American space. So I've included it here. And then before I go on, I'm going to talk about Gertrude Stein because she actually wrote a children's book. But before we talk about that, I want to just mention that in 1939, T.S. Eliot wrote a very, very famous children's poem called Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats. And it's a delightful poem. And I don't say that very often about a T.S. Eliot poem, and because it's not really my thing. He's not really my cup of tea. But he is from St. Louis. So I keep trying to like him better than I do. But this poem, I think, is exceptional. Probably my favorite T.S. Eliot poem. And it's the poem that begat the long-running musical, Cats. So it's the second poem in our list that had a trajectory that became a musical. But I'm not including this in our list. I'm actually putting this in extra reading because technically this was a UK phenomenon, the musical Cats. And the poem is full of references to London because T.S. Eliot left America and became a British citizen. So this is really not an American poem. But it is a huge selling children's poem by someone who is often considered an American poet, T.S. Eliot. And T.S. Eliot is going to be like W.H. Auden in that he's both considered British and American. And we'll talk about that when we get to those poets, but they're often in anthologies in both countries because they lived in both places. So that's an extra reading if you want to read it. Next, I want to talk about Gertrude Stein because she wrote a children's book in 1938 or 39. I see different dates for it. And it's full of verse and prose. And it's about this book, this children's book is kind of about the cult of the self and figuring out what your identity is, like, who am I? And she explores how boys and girls do this kind of identity questioning with different certainty, okay? The self-questioning and inner conflict is different for boys and girls. And I think anytime we read Gertrude Stein, the content's always going to be about perception too, and, you know, what is there, what is really there, and language games. A lot of people say that when you read this book aloud, and I would say this is probably good advice for reading any Gertrude Stein, if you read it aloud, it can be easier to understand and follow. So I've put in there two links, one with the full text of the children's book, and the second one, is about the illustrator and how they published books in different versions, and he had changed his illustration. Like, he had changed his idea about what the book meant. And so you can see the changes in his illustration as time passed and he reevaluated what he thought Gertrude Stein was talking about. So that's pretty interesting. The last poet in the modernist section we're going to talk about is Gwendolyn Brooks. And in 1956, she wrote the poem Cynthia in the Snow. And I've also included another 1956 poem called Rudolph is Tired of the City. Rudolph is Tired of the City. And so both of those poems are interesting poems about the self and being the road out of the city. Cynthia in the Snow is about the road out of the city, the quiet of the snow falling in the city. And so when you read the city poem, you can't help but compare it to a country poem. And so Rudolph is Tired of the City is also comparing the city and the country. And so this poem would be about multitudes, about people and different kinds of people living in different kinds of spaces. And so that's our modernists. And we are going to talk about the mid-century poets next.